Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. When Europeans first arrived in New England, the coastline had vast salt marshes and unobstructed riparian habitats. And as the population grew, so did the changes to the landscape. Salt marshes were filled in for development and rivers dammed for industrial and agricultural purposes. What we didn't realize was the long-term and negative impacts on biodiversity, water quality, and coastal resiliency. Over the last two decades, state, local municipalities, and nonprofits have collaborated to restore aquatic habitats. This hour, we'll talk about some of the past and current aquatic restoration projects in the region and what we're learning as those habitats return to a more natural state. We have a number of guests joining us throughout the hour, but with us for the duration, we're pleased to welcome back Beth Lambert. She's director of the Division of Ecological Restoration with the Massachusetts Department of Fish and Game. Hi, Beth.
Good morning.
Mike Locke's going to join us in a couple of minutes. He's executive director of Harwich Conservation Trust. Beth, you've been engaged in this work for some time. How does the state identify areas that have potential for restoration?
Sure. So there's many ways to think about how we identify and prioritize areas for restoration. The way that we do it within our division, so just for a quick background, we are a division of the Department of Fish and Game. Our mission is to restore and protect rivers, wetlands, and watersheds for the benefit of people and the environment. And so when we think about restoration, we think about the potential for ecological benefits to rivers and wetlands. We think about benefits to people, because that's an important part of our mission. So examples of benefits to people include things like flood resiliency resulting from removing aging dams, benefits to water quality, potentially new open space for new recreation. We think about job creation. And so we really look at those two things together, the potential ecological benefits. So what is the likelihood that the restoration actions are actually going to address the major stressors that are causing damaged rivers and wetlands? So the likelihood of seeing ecological benefit from the proposed actions, and then the benefit to people. And where those two things come together, and there's a local partner such as a town or a nonprofit organization or a landowner, then that's where we have a potential ecological restoration project.
Okay. Let's bring in Brian Wick. He's the executive director of the Cape Cod Cranberry Growers Association. Welcome.
Good morning.
So what features make Cape Cod a good place to grow cranberries?
So cranberries are native to the region. So they've been here for thousands of years. So this is their natural habitat. They need iron-rich water, low pH soils. They need cold winters in order to set fruit. You have to have a certain amount of hours of temperatures below 44 degrees Fahrenheit. So those are all the conditions that we have right here in southeastern Massachusetts. Oh, so
we can even find some wild cranberries, right?
There are pockets of wild cranberries, sure.
Yeah. So how have cranberry farmers modified the landscape to better suit cranberry farming?
So many of the industry started in Cape Cod. 1816 is when we first considered the first bog to be cultivated. So they've been growing here, farming for 200 plus years. And many of the bogs in the Cape, since the industry started here, are those original bogs. So they've been here for 100 plus years. What they would have done is either if it was a river flowing through with wet marshes on either side, they would have typically dammed either end of that stream so they could control the water. They may have straightened the river somewhat. They would have then taken those edges and created the bog systems with channels and ditches in them, and that would have become the cranberry bog. In other instances, they would have had bogs that are adjacent to a swamp or a pond or something like that, and that would have been their water source. Similarly, again, they would have went into the soil that was there, shaped it into the bogs. They would have dug it out somewhat because you wanted to have it closer to the water table, and that's how they would have created the bogs. So today, there's not really much of new construction of cranberry bogs.
Right. And cranberry farming, it's a lot of work. A lot of people don't, a lot of work all year, right? So how are local cranberry farmers faring economically? And is it a challenge to make a profit?
It's definitely challenging right now to be a cranberry grower, not much different than much of agriculture throughout the country. Its margins are tight. In cranberries, the costs continue to go up as we all feel it as consumers, inflationary costs. Our cranberry growers are seeing the same thing. The pricing has been going down slightly over the past several years, so it's not the right mix right now. It's not a dire situation. I'm not painting it as that, but it's certainly challenging economically. Climate change is playing a role in this. The growing season is longer, which means your growing costs go up because you're actually actively managing it for a longer period of time. So all those factors combining are making it challenging right now.
So do cranberry farmers typically own the land they farm, or do they lease it?
Most of them own it. There are some leased bogs, but the majority is owned land.
So what factors do farmers consider as they decide whether to continue farming a parcel, especially as you're talking about the challenges we're seeing now?
Right. So the average age of the farmer in Massachusetts, again, not much different than the rest of agriculture, is 60 plus years old. And if you're looking at your economics of your bog, many of our bogs, particularly here on the Cape, they're the older variety of cranberries. The same vine stock may have been there for 100 plus years. They're starting to lose their vigor. They're not producing as much. And there are new varieties of cranberries that are available to them, but they would have to literally scrape off the old vine material. You bring in fresh sand. That's the time you upgrade your irrigation system, plant the new vines. It takes costs approximately $50,000 per acre to do that.
Wow.
And it could be higher.
Yeah.
And so it's a big financial investment. It takes about 3 years to start getting a good crop again. So you have no crop production for a while. So the ROI when you renovate a cranberry bog or retool it, you're probably talking about 10 years to start making money again. Mm-hmm. So if you're 60 plus,
right,
and are you going to want to take that on? If you have the next generation ready behind you, okay, that's an easier decision to make. You still have to have the capital to do it, but you know you have someone else to pass this on to. The farm will continue. But for, again, a challenge not unique to cranberries, a lot of our younger generation is not looking to go into farming. It's hard work, low pay. It's a tough decision.
So talk a little bit then about the economic incentives for cranberry farmers to retire a bog rather than restore it.
So when your land is your retirement for a farmer, and if they're deciding that they want to move on, some of them are looking to retire just some of their portion of their bog. Maybe it's the section's not yielding as well. It's an environmentally sensitive area. They can retire part of that bog and focus the rest of their farming operation on their remaining farm. But if they're looking at what their options are, I mean, that's one option, but they may want to exit completely from the industry. And it's a big decision to make for a cranberry grower. These are multi-generational farms for the most part. It's a tough decision to say, I'm going to be the generation that stops farming. You know, my grandfather, great-grandfather, you know, you can understand it's a tough decision to need to make. But when you do make that decision, oftentimes our farmers are very loyal to the land. They consider themselves stewards of the land. If it's not going to be able to be farmed, the next best thing is let's restore it back to its natural wetland.
Yeah. Before we went on there, we were talking a little bit about some of the challenges. We're talking about the challenges that they're facing, but there's some incentive there when they can take part of the bog that's producing well, take another part, and actually get some money from that, the way the funding can be structured, right, from a couple of different organizations?
Yeah, so it's not necessarily a straightforward process to restore a cranberry bog because it could be multiple steps. As I mentioned, the land is the grower's asset, the farmer's asset. So to retire is to get some money for that asset. So there are government programs where they can purchase the agricultural rights for that property, which means it'll stop farming in perpetuity. But the farmer can get a cash payment for stopping that farming. So then they can take that money and invest it in the rest of their farm, or otherwise that becomes part of their retirement option. And then the second step would be if someone then comes in and actually purchases the land.
Now some they can, conservation group or something.
Exactly, yeah. Municipality, something like that. So now they can kind of cobble that together and have a better retirement option for that parcel.
Yeah. Beth, is funding through the state for aquatic habit restoration available only for public or municipal lands, or are private landowners eligible as well?
Private landowners are eligible goal as well. In fact, we are working with a private landowner right now in Carver, where he's actually, you know, one thing we find with cranberry growers, of course, is that they own quite a bit of heavy equipment that they've used for farming, and they know the land better than anyone else. And so in the case of this one project in Carver, we're actually able to contract directly with the landowner to do the restoration work himself and receive payment as essentially as the site contractor, rather than having to bid out that work to a separate construction company. But in other cases where the land has passed into public ownership, then it might be the town that's holding a construction contract, for example. So there's kind of a wide range of ways that this process can work out. The state brings funding, the federal government has brought funding for these types of projects in the past, and each project becomes its own unique combination of different funding sources, including sometimes private money, nonprofit funding, et cetera, to get the restoration work done. And the hope is that this provides, you know, what we call kind of a green exit strategy for those farmers that are interested in retiring certain parcels of land or perhaps leaving the farming industry.
Yeah. So Brian, how do, you know, I'm, as you're talking with this big dilemma, right? Do I want to retire this land? Do, you know, what, and how do you, you know, even let these cranberry farmers know that this is a possibility, or do you approach them and say, hey, have you ever thought about this? How does that process work?
Yeah, so our association, obviously our first task is we're trying to keep cranberry farmers farming.
Right.
That's goal number one. But we recognize that there is a certain percentage that are looking to exit some or all of their acreage. And so we're our resource to them. We try to put them in touch with other organizations. We've done some presentations, some outreach in that regard. We're working with the state ecological restoration, Mass Audubon, and others to put together brochures. It's a multifaceted approach. There's not one approach that's going to work at all. But we're trying to make our growers aware of what the opportunities are and the challenges that come with it. I mean, we're not sugarcoating it right. That, oh, this is a piece of cake. You know, there's a lot of red tape that goes with this and putting together the financial deals. It's a long process, and it's not always easy. So we're just trying to expose the growers that are interested to what this is all about and how it works.
Brian Wicks, Executive Director of the Cape Cod Cranberry Growers Association. Thanks for taking time to be with us. Appreciate that.
Happy to do it.
Coming up after break, what it takes to revert a man-made cranberry bog to its original state. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing aquatic restoration projects this hour. With us is Beth Lambert, Director of the Division of Ecological Restoration in the State Department of Fish and Game. Joining us, Michael Locke, Executive Director of the Harwich Conservation Trust. Hi, Michael.
Hi, everyone.
Nick Nelson, who's the fluvial geomorphologist, if I said that right, who's worked on several restoration projects on the Cape. Welcome.
Morning.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Nick, what exactly is a fluvio geomorphologist? That's a mouthful.
It's close. A fluvial geomorphologist is somebody who studies and learns about the interactions between rivers and floodplains and the landscapes. So it's the fluvial part is the river component. Geomorphology is the changing of the landscape.
Yeah. So tell us about the different aquatic restoration projects that you've been involved with on the Cape.
Yeah, so we have been really fortunate in being involved in a number of different efforts on Cape Cod and southeastern Massachusetts. Many of them related to these cranberry bog projects that you were just talking about earlier. The company I work for is Interfluve, and we're a river and wetland restoration firm. And I grew up in Harwich in cranberry country. And so coming back home to Harwich and Cape Cod to work on these projects was super exciting for me. We've been able to work with the town of Falmouth on the Coonamessett River, restoring cranberry bogs to these native wetland and river systems. others in Harwich and working on the design process in Harwich and Yarmouth and Marston's Mills and Falmouth and Mashpee as well right now. So dam removals, bog restorations, many of those coastal restorations as well in these systems.
So what kinds of information do you need to design a restoration? I mean, are there clues in the landscape or historical documents that help you get a picture of what the habitat looked like before it was altered?
Yes, all of that. So because we've altered our landscape for hundreds of years, it's really hard to find written or mapped documentation of what it looked like prior to European settlement and colonization. But we can try to find those clues, as you mentioned. For these cranberry bog projects, we look to old maps, and we can get clues from that, from the 16 and 1700s sometimes. There might be indications of what it once was. But we can also study the landscape and probe or survey the landscape and see what's underneath the sand and cranberry mats. So we can see how thick the sand layer is, and we can see how thick the peat is, the underlying organic material underneath. So that gives us a really good sense of maybe what kind of ecosystem was there. And then the trick is, how do we think about what's next? You know, how do we convert this altered landscape in this new climate change driven, you know, new ecosystem that we have into a restored ecosystem that supports the goals of the particular project?
Yeah, a lot involved there. And I think anybody who has seen an aquatic restoration project during construction likely had a little bit of a shock, right? Beth mentioned in the bog and Carver, the farmer had all that big, heavy equipment. So you got this big, heavy equipment, piles of dirt, large stumps. Walk us through the different stages of construction.
Yeah, it is definitely a bit of a shock. What typically happens first is as the contractor enters the site, you'll see, you know, traffic control signs go up, erosion control signs go up. They're trying to prevent erosion from the staging area from washing into the stream systems. But then the shocking part is that the machines go into the river and the wetland, and we're not used to seeing that happen. And so there's lots of permits that we have to go through to get permission to do this, certainly. And there are restrictions on what the contractor can do. You can't work in actively moving water during fish runs, for instance, because we don't want to impact the fish moving up and downstream. So there are certain conditions that are put on that, but the contractors are in there. They have big, heavy excavators on these bog complexes, and they're sitting on timber mats or mud mats, they're called, so they stay afloat. Otherwise, they would sink in to the sand and peat underneath. And there's big dump trucks that are hauling away sand. And so it's, you know, days and days, weeks, months. I think we were in construction in Falmouth for, you know, 9 months for the lower Cunamessa River. So sometimes most of the year is spent working on these efforts, digging the new stream channel, putting in large wood for habitat, creating ponds. And then the whole replanting process as well happens towards the end.
Yeah. Beth's been nodding her head through this as you're talking. And Beth, and I bet you also people don't understand. So they go, but they go, and you probably get a lot of complaints. What are you doing, right, with people who are walking by or see the construction projects underway?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, luckily at this point, there's a large number of cranberry bog restoration projects that have been completed. And what we've seen is that within that first growing season after construction, the plants recover immediately. And you start seeing wetland grasses. You start seeing wildflowers in certain cases. You see a lot of different wildlife. And so just as that construction is shocking to people while it's happening, this amazing burst of life and biodiversity that happens just that following growing season is equally amazing and surprising to people. And so now that we know that, we have a lot of pictures and imagery and videos from successful projects, both on the Cape and Southeastern Mass, that we can share with people in advance of construction to say, you know, warning, we're going to be very clear with you. This is going to look very, very messy. But remember, we're undoing 200 years worth of damage. Mm-hmm. So it's 200 years worth of damage, 9 months of messiness, and then this incredibly beautiful, vibrant, biodiverse wetland that will carry forth in perpetuity. Yeah. So it's really an extraordinary process to witness. And now that we have successful projects, we're able to communicate that.
Yeah. Mike,
springboarding on Nick and Beth's comments about the before and after experience of these exciting eco-restoration projects. If any of your listeners are driving through Harwich, they can see the eco-restoration construction happening from the road right there at the corner of Headwaters Drive and Route 124 opposite the Cape Cod Regional Technical High School with the Hinckley's Pond Herring River Headwaters Eco-Restoration Project, which is focused on rewilding two retired bogs, bracketing 174-acre Hinckley's Pond, which is a herring spawning pond. And just down the road about a mile is a recently completed eco-restoration at the Robert F. Smith Coldbrook Preserve. And that restored nearly a mile of stream and 44 acres of adjoining wetland habitat, as well as to a point Beth made at the outset, enhancements for the visitor experience. There's now a half mile all persons trail there. So folks of all physical abilities and families with youngsters and strollers eager to get outside can get closer to these restored landscapes.
Mm, yeah, that's awesome. This is a question for anybody who wants to jump in. Marianne writes, it's exciting to see the results of restoration projects like the Kunameset River Project. Are there any projects looking to restore the native beaver population? Once important to native peoples and the local ecology, their habitat was soon destroyed by early settlers. As the wetlands and bogs are restored, I hope we can welcome them back. Anybody have thoughts on that?
I'll take a stab first and maybe others can jump in. It's a really, really good question. And it's something that we've thought about in this region. One of the larger restorations of retired cranberry bogs was the Tidmarsh Farms project in Plymouth, almost 200 acres of cranberry bog. And that was on Beaver Dam Brook. So a place that we know there were beavers historically, and there aren't currently. I have heard of some beavers coming back into Plymouth, potentially. So like that's the first step. You know, I think, or that's a step, I should say. These systems, that as they're being restored, they are just set up for beavers if they're able to come back. Mm-hmm. Wide wetlands, streams, water, new plantings all over the place. You know, the vegetation growth is off the charts. So the opportunity is there. The challenge in our region is there's so much infrastructure around bridges, culverts, that sort of thing that, you know, beaver dams could potentially impact. And so that's why, you know, one of the reasons they were driven out originally, and one of the challenges with bringing them back into our particular ecosystem.
Nick, I think this is a question for you, and this is from Paul. It says, what could or should be done about abandoned bogs that have naturally regrown pitch pine and other trees or shrubs?
Yeah, that's a really good observation, and that is generally the direction that these bogs will go when they're abandoned with no alterations done. So because of that sand that was placed by farmers over 200 years, you might have 2 feet of sand on the historical wetland soils, and that separates the ground surface from the groundwater. And so it turns into an upland forest dominated by these pitch pines. So there, some of these parcels that we work on have all of those trees growing, and the restoration practice there is removing many of those trees, removing a good chunk of the sand, filling some of the ditches, and reconnecting the hydrology to the ground surface. Yeah. All of that takes a lot of this cost and planning and time to do. So there are potentially simpler processes for smaller individual bogs, but that's a general practice.
We're going to bring in Chris Neal, senior scientist, Woodwell Climate Research, who studies natural and restored ecosystems around the globe, including some right here on the Cape. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I agree with Nick entirely on this one that we've actually gone out. Sarah Kleonski, a colleague of mine who's a plant ecologist, we worked and we looked at various bogs from active bogs to long retired bogs to look at exactly that vegetation trajectory that Nick is describing. And he's nailed it. It's exactly what happens. The fact that cranberry growing puts layers of sand on the bog every several years, and this facilitates the fruiting of the cranberries, but it over time builds up a big layer of sand that separates the soil surface from the water table. So if you just walk away from a cranberry bog without filling ditches, without doing the work to raise the water table and sort of turn it back into a wetland, you end up with a forest that's dominated by more upland species of plants. And what we find when we survey that trajectory is that, yeah, the biodiversity goes up quite quickly after bog retirement. Lots of new plants come in that were kept out during the active growing phase. But then over time, that canopy closes and the biodiversity starts to go down. And what we're doing now is comparing that trajectory with the trajectory that the Mass Division of Ecological Restoration and Beth's group is working with landowners to do, is to do this more active restoration, send in the big equipment, push dirt into the ditches, remove the water control structures, raise that water table up, scrape off some of the sand, and what you get is a very different trajectory. And what do we care about in that trajectory? We don't want invasive plants coming in. We want native plants, and we also want wetland-adapted plants. We want plants because these wetlands are relatively rare on the landscape compared with upland forest. So rather than have these retired farms go back to a very common and not so unique habitat, we're pushing them to become these wetlands, which are these reservoirs of different plants. And what we found is that there's an enormous already buried seed bank in those active farm soils, and all you have to do is mix them up a bit and make them a little wetter, and you get this flush of native and wetland-adapted plants. So the trajectory is very different and much more toward wetland species, higher biodiversity. And now that we have projects that are sort of beginning to be 7 to 10 years old, we can look at what the long-term trajectory is under active restoration versus the just simple retirement scenario.
That buried seed thing is pretty fascinating in itself, isn't it? That they're just kind of waiting there. These seeds are waiting there for the right opportunity, right?
It's a feature of the evolution of wetland plants.
Yeah.
Wetlands, water levels vary in wetlands. The plants that grow in wetlands have adapted to fluctuating water level conditions. So they've evolved long-lived seeds that just lie dormant when land is flooded or when land, you know, and they're just waiting until the right conditions. And the right conditions are sort of what we aim for in this active restoration. That is, create a mudflat that's wet.
Yeah.
And that moist soil system is just this sort of magic formula for producing this this enormous diversity of wetland plants.
Right.
And in fact, they're some of the most diverse, in terms of plant diversity, these recently created restored wetlands are some of the most diverse plant communities we have in the entire state of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. Nick, are most bogs able to be restored to native habitat, or are there some limiting factors?
Yeah, I think one question that goes along with that is what is the native habitat? And I think going back to our earlier conversation, it's sort of we're in this new system now with climate change and a new hydrologic system and infrastructure around us. So what we're looking to restore and recover is more of some of the processes within the constraints that we have. So yes, we can certainly on any of these projects, we can restore processes, we can store form and function, full, recovery to what it once was, certainly not. But within the constraints that we have, absolutely.
Yeah. Michael, these restoration projects are a collaboration. Tell us a little bit more about the different agencies and groups who work on these projects and how their expertise is used.
The Holbrook Eco Restoration Project in Harwichport was made possible by partnership with the state's Division of Ecological Restoration, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The town of Harwich played a critical role, especially regarding their interest in enhancing the nitrogen reduction of the wetland, of the restored wetlands, in so that the town could save money long term by reducing the amount of wastewater infrastructure within the watershed. Other partners included, most recently, the nonprofit Harwich Fire Association. Believe it or not, it's interesting. Public safety organization with a conservation oriented assemblage of groups. Their focus at this particular site was historic preservation and affordable housing, while we were focusing on public access and eco restoration. And of course, this amazing team of technical expertise, Nick, among the leaders of that effort. And Ed Eichner, consulting with the town, working specifically on the water quality aspect. I want to mention again, Division of Ecological Restoration. They are key to this effort at rewilding these areas. They are able to communicate the benefits clearly and in a compelling way to the public. They also have incredible resources in terms of their technical knowledge on how to manage and see these projects through to completion. So it's a real team effort.
Yeah. Beth, what role does the state have in permitting and signing off on these projects? And how are these major reconstruction projects funded?
Yeah, those are great questions. So our division does not have any regulatory role in any of these ecological restoration projects. Our mission is purely to work in the trenches with groups like Michael Locke's to plan and carry out these projects. However, there is a very intensive regulatory and permitting process that ecological restoration projects that take place in rivers and wetlands must go through in order to be permitted and take place. And so that includes everything from the local conservation commission, so municipal level, to the department, the State Department of Environmental Protection for certain aspects of the project, sometimes more than two or three permits from that agency. If there's a dam, there could be a requirement for authorization from the Office of Dam Safety. There's typically coordination with on historic issues, both at the state level and potentially the federal level. And then there's also Army Corps of Engineers approval needed. Mm-hmm. So it's a very complex process. And one of the things that our staff do, because they are very well versed and have worked on multiple projects, is help municipalities and landowners and nonprofits figure out what information is needed for engineering and design, and then how to translate that into permit applications, and then how to guide the project through the regulatory process in order to get to construction. So in general, engineering and design can take, say, a year and a half. Permitting can take anywhere from 1 to 2 years. And then construction, depending on the size of the project, can be a couple months, to a year or more. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of funding, that's part of our role too, is to put together that patchwork and that pie of funding sources. And so each project ends up being a complex patchwork of federal, state, and local funding sources. And we help by writing grants, by identifying which funding sources are going to make the most sense, and then helping the local lead for the project figure out kind of how to how to match the different funding sources to the different phases of the project and the different goals. So it gets very complicated.
Say a lot to it, right?
Yeah.
Right. Nick Nelson is a fluviogeomorphologist. Thanks so much for being with us, Nick. We appreciate your time.
Very much.
Coming up after break, changes in biodiversity and water quality after restoring aquatic habitats. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point, and we're discussing aquatic restoration projects this hour. With us is Beth Lambert, Director of the Division of Ecological Restoration in the State Department of Fish and Game, Michael Locks, Executive Director of the Harwich Conservation Trust, Chris Neal, Senior Scientist at Woodwell Climate Research, and joining us now is Edward Eichner, Water Scientist, TMDL Solutions, and Adjunct Professor at the Coastal Systems Program at the School of Marine Science and Technology at the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth. Hi, Edward.
Good morning.
So, Chris, many people enjoy the history of Cape Cod cranberry farming, seeing the bogs in production and walking through them. And if we walk through actively farmed bogs, we can spot quite a few different species of animals and birds, right? So you're a scientist and you're looking at these spaces from a different perspective. So what do you see when you look at a cultivated cranberry bog in contrast to a bog that's been restored?
So I think I've been working mostly on plants, but I'm an avid birder, so I pay attention to birds too. And cultivation of cranberries is, like almost every agricultural crop, an attempt to optimize the production of one species over other species of plants. Cranberries happen to be a native plant, so growing them involves practices that simulate in some ways the conditions that they grew in naturally, sort of in swales behind dunes at the edges of marshes. But some of that involved placing sand, some of that involved, you know, regular flooding to facilitate harvest. So there were just alterations of the environment that were required for growing that one specific plant. There's a book that Cranberry Station, the UMass Cranberry Station, puts out, and it's the weeds that farmers encounter in cranberry bogs. And I look through that book and I say, well, these are all the wonderful native plants that we that we want to encourage to come back. The fortunate thing is many of them are there. They're in the ditches, they're around the edges. So when you do these things that Nick and Beth have been talking about, that is fill ditches, dig up the mat, flip over the mat, expose some mineral and sandy soil underneath, you get this flush of regrowth that from seeds that are already there. So that's nature working with the restoration team to not have to go out and seed and find seed sources. Those seed sources are already there. So you get this enormous increase in diversity. There might be in a bog bed, one diked in bog bed, you might have 10 to 14 species of plants in an active farm, even if you're looking in the ditches. But if you know, 1 year after the restoration, you've got 45 species, 99% of them are native species, and about 60 to 70% are wetland adapted species, sort of just the just the target species you want.
And so, just even the variety of all the species attract different types of wildlife and birds.
So then the two things, the diversity of plants begets a diversity of animals and other species, so you'll immediately get birds like red-winged blackbirds that like to nest in marshy areas coming into these places. But it's also the diversity of habitat created. One of the things that Nick's firm, Interfluve, has really pushed is the creation of what they call microtopography. That is, not make it flat. The bogs are flat because farmers want to raise the water level, and they want that water level to be the same everywhere. Facilitates harvest. It helps the plants keep their roots with the right amount of moisture. But what you want to do to make it natural is undo that. You want a whole bunch of different varieties. So you've got wet spots, you've got dry spots. So you've got wet spots that facilitate the more wet adapted plants. And you get all the diversity that comes with drier spots up on the little hummocks. Yeah. So part of that, and then you've got amphibians and other things sort of loaded with spring peepers and other amphibians that gravitate to these systems because there's this ephemeral water. Mm-hmm. And I also think that ephemerality, that diversity of elevations that are created in these restorations helps adapt to whatever future climate will bring, because you're not setting the whole thing at one level. You're creating a gradient that, you know, so if it's a dry year, there will still be wet spots. If it's a wet year, there will still be the upland edges. And so that's, we try to build that into the to the restoration to create an adaptability to future climate.
Edward, nitrogen loading from septic systems and fertilizers has degraded water quality in our bays and marshes. Can restoring aquatic habitats like cranberry bogs help improve water quality? And if so, how?
Absolutely. I mean, part of what we did, why we were involved in the Colebrook restoration, was trying to expand the universe of benefits that you were going to get out of doing this type of restoration. And what we looked at was characterizing where the groundwater comes in, where the nitrogen comes into the system, trying to get to a situation where there's actually a reduction in the nitrogen that comes out of Colebrook that goes to Sackwatucket Harbor. When we did the estuaries project analysis or assessment of Sackwatucket Harbor, it was impaired, and there was about a 35% attenuation reduction in the nitrogen that was coming from the watershed that fed into Colebrook. And we were figuring that if you did slow the water down, gave the plants that you were putting in there during the restoration a better chance to take up the nitrogen, you could reduce the nitrogen down, so you actually get to not only the restoration benefits that Nick and Chris have been talking about, but you also get the nitrogen reductions that the town is searching for in terms of their trying to get to meeting the nitrogen standards that the state has imposed on Sackwatucket Harbor.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, Ed, that's great. And I think that project will function in that way. And we have evidence from the lower section of the Coonamessett River that the same exact process is happening, that there's a reduction of about 50% of the nitrogen. If you calculate the nitrogen that's coming into the, hitting the lower Coonamessett River, or flowing down the channel, about 50% of what we calculate comes in actually goes out the bottom in this now restored reach of river. So that's an enormous value to the town, because the town of Falmouth, as all Cape towns, are struggling to try to find ways of taking out nitrogen. All of them are expensive. This restoration is sort of a natural service that can be built into these new, what the town has to develop is watershed management plans that would deploy various a suite of techniques, some sewering, some denite septic systems, and maybe some restoration. Restoration can be part of that solution to solve the nitrogen problem, and the evidence is mounting that these places, especially places like Colebrook and the lower Coonamessett, where upstream is a lot of land with houses on septic systems contributing a lot of nitrate. These bogs are positioned perfectly to be nitrate attenuators in those situations. That's not true everywhere in the cranberry landscape. There are places high up in watersheds without much nitrogen coming in. But with some judicious site selection, I think you can build in quite a bit of nitrogen attenuation to these restoration projects.
The Cape, of course, has lost historical herring runs due to habitat degradation. And the Coonamessett River Restoration Project, there are herring counters set up. So are we seeing herring return there? And what else are we learning about herring and other native fish species who use that habitat?
So I'll try to answer that, because I've been involved in the Coonamessett River restoration since its inception. And one of the goals was to remove the barriers to herring movement from Great Pond, where they come in, to Coonamessett Pond, where the majority of them spawn. And we had evidence from tagging of herring and watching them hit these antennas that we set up along the river. We knew there were pinch points in their migration, that they would hit a culvert. There was a crushed culvert that went under John Parker Road. That was a hang-up spot for herring, and the herring would, you know, would spend hours, if not a day or two, in these hang-up spots before they would go through this very tight spot. And of course, some of them got through, but they always spent more energy making their way up. Without those, we know the herring passed directly through. So their passage has been improved, which is one of the goals of the Division of Ecological Restoration's restoration and dam removals that are part of these restorations. So we don't, you know, many factors control herring populations. They tend to vary year to year. Herring populations tend to do similar things regionally. So we don't have the absolute solid evidence that the population is now sort of suddenly rebounded. I don't think we can expect that, mm-hmm. but I think we've removed a lot of the stressors within the freshwater portion of their lifestyle, and I think that's something that these restorations will be very effective at doing.
Edward, one of the joys and maybe challenges of science is something unexpected. And as a water scientist, has there been something surprising or unexpected in water quality that you've seen in aquatic rehabilitation projects?
I think in large part, one of the things that when we were working on the estuaries project, we focused really on just the near shore area into the estuary. We looked at the watersheds. But one of the things that we're finding as we go along and towns are trying to tackle their wastewater and nitrogen management stuff is that as you start to walk inland, you find out that there are particular niches within each of these watersheds where you could get the benefits of doing things like these restorations that may reduce the nitrogen without having to put in sewers or without having to do alternative septic systems or things like that, just by doing the restoration itself. I mean, one of the things that we found in Cold Brook was, you know, people tend to look at these rivers and say, okay, there's flow that gains because there's more groundwater that's coming in as you go along. What we found in Cold Brook was there was a section where that's where the majority of the watershed came in. It was actually much further down the river. And so when we were talking about designing the restoration, that's where we put the ponds, mm. because that would be where the nitrogen would hang out for a longer period of time.
Yeah. All right, Michael, we have like about a minute and a half, so you get the final word. Go ahead.
One of the unexpected surprises related to the design that Ed was just summarizing at Colebrook was that we had a family of river otters discover the revitalized Colebrook and the four new ponds. And these celebrity otters have now been added to the cover of the town's chamber summer magazine, which is pretty neat. Folks are seeing that connection between protecting, restoring the environment and the local economy, which of course the Cape Cod's nature holds us here and draws so many more.
For sure. All right, we have a minute left. Beth, I'm going to ask you this. Is there evidence that restored aquatic habitats are more resilient to storm surge or severe rainstorms than areas altered by humans?
Yes, they are. The natural wetlands can provide that buffering and storm surge. And in addition, as sea level rises, many of these low-lying bogs provide an opportunity for salt marshes to migrate inland and continue to provide that buffering ability.
Yeah, awesome. Ed Eichner is water scientist, TMDL Solutions, and adjunct professor at the Coastal Systems Program at the School of Marine Science and Technology at University of Mass Dartmouth. Chris Neal, senior scientist, Woodwell Climate Research, studies natural and restored ecosystems around the globe. Beth Lambert's director of the Division of Ecological Restoration in the State Department of Fish and Game, and Michael Locke's executive director of the Harwich Conservation Trust. We'll post the links with information about some of the aquatic restoration projects we discussed at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you all for being here. Very fascinating. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.